From the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Jacob H. Rooksby is an experienced academic, administrator, and attorney with a proven track record of leadership and innovation in higher education. Appointed Dean of Gonzaga University School of Law in 2018, Rooksby has focused on enhancing the law school's academic programs, modernizing its facilities, and integrating it more fully into the university and regional communities.
Welcome to the G Suite Podcast. We have a very special guest today, the Dean of the Law School, the Smith Moore P. Myers Dean of the Law School. Is that correct?
That is, yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Jacob Rooksby, live from the Hogan Boardroom today. And we want to talk about a couple things. We're all personal friends here, and kind of over the years, we've kind of kicked around some ideas. But first, I want to talk a little bit about you, if that's possible. And you've been dean for 7-8 years, longer than that.
Yeah, this is my eighth year.
Eighth year as dean, and ushered in a lot of new programs and change at the law school. You can kind of help me out as I go, but I know numbers have been really strong, both enrollments, LSAT. I just saw on LinkedIn today, 100% bar passage rate for the executive JD program.
Yeah, we're really happy about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. You inherited an executive JD program, but I think kind of took it to the next level. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'll jump in there. We had what at the time we were calling an accelerated program, and it was a 2-year JD, as it is now, but it lacked any kind of curricular focus. And one of the concerns was it's not very economical to run both a 3-year program and a 2-year program and allow students to choose their own adventure within each. So we had some situations where it was just, particularly in the summer when most of our faculty are off contract, the cost of labor was significant to run that program. And students are paying full tuition and expecting a full array of electives and course offerings and all those kinds of things. So we had some concerns about our ability to do that going forward. And we were also coming up on a site visit where a lot of this stuff was going to be scrutinized, so accreditation visit. And so we changed the program to give it more of a business and leadership focus. And so what we did was basically say there's more of a required curriculum for students in that 2-year program. And we rebranded it as the Executive 2-Year JD program, really being kind of intentional in marketing it to students who had some additional life experience beyond college, business work experience that they're bringing into that program. And as you know, different from before, where we were just sort of saying, who wants to do a JD for 3 years? Who wants to do it for 2 years? And come on in. And so that changed how we thought about it. It also changed how we staffed the program. We had some colleagues here in the School of Business, including you in the early years.
I thought you were going to say that's when things kind of turned around.
That's when we really knew we had the right path forward. But it also then made that program distinct and different for those students in the cohort. We've learned a lot of things over the years with that program and kind of how we have to continue to innovate and evolve, and be really clear in the marketing too about what it is and what it isn't. It's not a great program for students who want to, say, have a career, you know, as a public defender or a prosecutor. It's not a program that is going to enable students to do everything that students can do in the 3-year program. And so we have to be very clear about that in the front end of the marketing.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I had a cousin who completed it, actually, too. Was a big fan. On the still professional side, but not necessarily law school specific, Gonzaga related, you authored a treatise, I believe still do, on education law.
I do. Law and higher education, yeah.
Higher education, yeah. You also hold a position at a local patent law firm, Fig One Patents. Mm-hmm. Spent some time there as well. With respect to the law school, I know there's been some new clinics that have come up. I mean, there's been some historic clinics. I've been familiar with the federal tax clinic there. But what are some of the new things that are developing down there on that front?
Sure. So I think the first clinic that in my time we started was in partnership with Catholic Charities of Eastern Washington. We opened up an immigration law clinic. And that was in 2019 that we started that project. It has grown and blossomed since then. There's obviously no shortage of need in the area of immigration, and particularly here in the Inland Northwest. And Catholic Charities had more work than they could handle, and they were looking for someone to partner with them in that. And we had at the time some expertise on the faculty and some interest in immigration law. And so it was a really a natural fit in terms of our mission and opening that up. And we have seen just record enrollments and interest in that clinic. We've now had some turnover on the faculty. We have new leadership that we've brought in that's been really impactful to continue that. And we have some real flagship benefaction for that clinic as well. Ed and Beatrice Schweitzer and their family are big proponents of immigration and have been extremely generous to our law school. So that was the first one. The second one was our Lincoln LGBTQ Rights Clinic, which has also done some really, impactful and unique work. We're one of only a handful of, I think, five or six law schools nationwide that have an LGBTQ rights clinic. We're the first Catholic law school to have a LGBTQ rights clinic. And, they're doing work for clients in, Idaho, Western Montana, Washington State, clients who are facing discrimination because of their identity. And so again, I think it's part of our humanistic mission to do this kind of work. It has attracted a lot of attention in the community with prospective students. Just the fact of having that clinic has been something that is on the minds of many when they're coming to our law school. We've also more recently opened up a number of different business-related clinics. We have now a patent clinic. We have a trademark clinic. Actually, during COVID, I restarted our business clinic, and we started to brand it as our business innovation clinic. So I taught that for a year. And it's going strong now under the leadership of Chris Mercado. And I'm trying to think what else. Most recently, this past fall, we, in partnership with our Climate Institute here at Gonzaga, reopened an environmental justice clinic. And so that is just starting actually this fall. So a little bit of a flavor of what we're doing. I learned just today, I mean, we have 12 clinics and for a law school our size, that's actually quite a few. And we have more spots in those clinics than most law schools have in their clinics. I just learned today the dean of Creighton Law School is visiting. As of 3 years ago, they had one clinic at Creighton Law School. And it's a little bit smaller than our law school, but not by a lot. So for us to have these, the variety that we have and the number that we have is actually to our, I think, to our credit. And make sure, helps make sure that our students are getting practical education when they come here.
Yeah, we're big on the experiential learning on this side of campus too. True or false, Gonzaga Law has more state Supreme Court justices than any other law school, or is it West Coast or maybe across the country? We have a number to get.
So we have more sitting state Supreme Court justices
Awesome.
than excuse me, more sitting state Supreme Court chief justices than any other law school. In terms of total number of justices, I don't know.
One last thing I had here recently, I was with you in a meeting where you got approval for a 3+1 clinic or a program. Can you talk a little about that for Gonzaga undergrads and other schools? I believe you also
Three plus three.
3+3. Sorry.
Yeah. So a 3+3 program, these are unique programs where a highly motivated, qualified undergraduate student can complete an undergraduate degree and a law degree in 6 years as opposed to seven. And so that last year of what otherwise would be their undergraduate, BA or BS, they don't get their degree yet. They're taking instead a full year of courses at the law school, the first year of our JD program. At the successful completion of that year, they receive their undergraduate degree, and then they continue on in the second, third year of law school. So obviously, there's a cost savings. It allows them to get into their career quicker. It's Only the right kind of program, though, for a student who's highly motivated, know that laws, they know that, a legal career is what they want to pursue. And so for students who are coming back to college, for example, from military service, from having a family, from working, it can be quite appealing because they can pursue their dream of becoming a lawyer and pay a little bit less on the way and get there sooner than they otherwise would.
Nice, nice. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce my co-host today, Dr. Ryan Herzog. And it sounds like he's got a question.
Well, the 3+3, because that's something that we're looking at partnering with you as well. And I know you partnered with Eastern Washington. I think that was the first
Yeah.
partnership was
We have
based.
one with Whitworth, Eastern Washington, Carroll College, and now the Arts and Sciences College at Gonzaga.
So for students, we've seen an increase in LSATs, students taking the LSAT exams, an increase in the desire to go to law school, right? What advice or what, when we're getting 18, 19-year-old students, like go back to when you decided you wanted to do law school, right? What was those driving factors to push people into law? There's a lot of tying this into uncertainty around career paths today. Like, what is that motivation for the student that is thinking of law school?
He
Right.
decided when he was five.
I know he came
I
out like
can see
knowing.
it.
Well, I think it's a good question. And I think students today have access to so much more information about career pathways and outcomes and choices and actual costs than students did when we were considering these things. And, to be honest, in my situation, how I got to law school, it was at a time period where it was deemed just a great, safe option of something to do next if you like to talk, read, write, and argue. And that applied to me.
Check, check.
So I think now, what I am seeing are students are doing their homework and they are very attuned to cost and outcome. And, at the same time, I think there are things going on in society that are suggesting that having additional education is a good thing and it positions one to, to be employable in an era of artificial intelligence and other factors. So far, law is an industry that's showing itself to be, I wouldn't say by any means insulated from these trends, but we still find that clients are paying lawyers for their work. And why is that? And I think it's because at the end of the day, it's judgment, it's wisdom, it's that human connection. And that's an important element. Even when you can get some answers online that might be pretty accurate, you're not going to get that machine to walk into court for you, and you can get that machine to write a brief for you, but you don't really know is it good or not. You're putting your trust in the machine, and so we're still seeing great interest in legal education. I think because it's advanced learning that is going to continue to put our graduates in positions of trust. And in this day and age, trust is really, really important. How do we know what's true? How do we know what's good? Having an attorney who can help navigate life's challenges, I think, is going to be important for everyone. I always say, sure, you can do your own tax return, but you might find that you get a better return if you pay a professional to do it. You can do your own legal work on Zoom or using various different artificial intelligence tools, but it might not lead to the outcome that you really want. And when life, liberty, and property are on the line, I'm going to want a really knowledgeable human to help me. So I'm seeing that students are aware of these trends and thinking about them and asking the right questions. We're very transparent about our cost structure at Gonzaga Law School, which I'm very proud of. A lot of law schools is a whole other topic, but they are basically chasing a high LSAT profile by giving those students, full ride tuition and then saddling the lower quartile of their class with, more than their share of the burden. And yet that lower quartile, based upon LSAT score and GPA, are at higher risk of not passing the bar exam. So you're essentially saying you're going to pay more to go to law school, and the risk of you being successful is higher. That doesn't seem fair or right to me or to us and our philosophy here at a Jesuit law school. So we've taken a totally different approach, And sometimes students at the higher end of that profile will say, well, wait a minute, why am I not receiving a higher scholarship? And we say, because after a certain level, we just max out. We're not giving you more for incremental increases in your LSAT score. There's more to it than the test, too. And so we are not a school that has played that game and chased, those scores just for the sake of telling everyone that we have some high median LSAT. At the same time, we have seen our median LSAT go up 2 points in the 8 years that I've been here. And that hasn't been really reflective of a super intentional strategy, but what we're seeing is we're becoming more competitive as our brand is extending, further across the United States. And so we're drawing students from places that we didn't draw them before, and we're getting them to come here. When I started, we were 60% in-state and 40% out of state. And now those numbers have reversed.
We're recruiting students from out of state, and apparently we are recruiting deans from out of state, right? As you were Pennsylvania in Duquesne before you jumped over to
Yeah, it was a big
the West
move.
Side.
It was a big move, and I remember when we came here. I mean, I think I'd been to Seattle once, and incidentally, I got there via train, and so I guess I'd been to Spokane too, at like 2 in the morning when the Empire Builder comes through. I took my dad on a train trip. He loves trains back in 2017. So we went from Chicago to Seattle. But that was really my only time in the Pacific Northwest. And I didn't at all think, gosh, I'm going to be here one day. And then a headhunter contacted me, and it was the right time in my career for a career move. But I also just got lucky and feel very fortunate to be here. And also learned a lot too, that we don't have a lot of people moving here from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So when people said, where are you coming from? They expected me to say, Seattle, the West Side or Tri-Cities maybe, or somewhere in Idaho. And then we'd say, Pittsburgh. And they're like, what, you mean like Pennsylvania? So why are you here? Gonzaga.
But not a Pittsburgh Steeler fan, correct?
Well, actually I am.
Oh no.
Go Steelers.
Wow, bold. That's on the second
Absolutely.
of us. That's
Absolutely.
right. I guess the Southern Indiana
I
Pittsburgh
mean,
connection.
yeah, and Colts too, but it's much, much to my dad's chagrin, more of a Steelers fan. That's how they pronounce it in Pittsburgh. Not Steelers, Steelers. Yeah,
Steelers.
there's a whole vernacular there that is actually pretty hard to imitate, but they have their own
The
dialect.
Yinzers.
Yeah, that's right, the Yinzer dialect.
Ah,
One is
fun.
to say down, it's not downtown, it's downtown. Downtown.
Yeah. Well, fun fact, you may be aware of this. I think at one point Bing Crosby owned had an interest in the Pirates.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know
A
that.
picture of
Another
Bing
fun
Crosby.
fact, at one point in time, he was a Gonzaga law student. He completed his
He
first year
did.
of studies
There you
with
go.
us, but then got away for other
He had other
pursuits.
things. Now he's gone. You mentioned AI a little bit ago. How's that changing what you're doing down at the law school? You talked a little bit about the practice of law and how you can utilize AI, but how are you guys approaching this revolution?
Yeah, it's really, I think, impacting most our teaching and understanding of legal research and writing, which is such a big part of the law school curriculum traditionally. And it's a really hard part for most students because it's looking at the blank page and knowing what to put on it. And, there have always been forms. So if somebody goes to practice with a large law firm and you have to draft a complaint, you're really not, doing it from scratch. You're looking at past complaints that the firm has drafted. You're, mixing and matching and editing from those kinds of things and adapting it to your context. Obviously, now with large language models and AI, all of this can be done with the punch of a button, and the options and the things are, extreme. So we're having to bring that into the curriculum. Our faculty are having to get up to speed with it. At the same time, vendors that we use, like LexisNexis, Westlaw, these are legal research tools for attorneys and law students, they're incorporating AI into their platforms. So our research librarians are helping faculty and students understand the new tools that are available. But that's for the actual writing of things. We still have to know what we're writing about and what we're talking about. So this gets to the wisdom thing. I mean, sure, I can have somebody draft a complaint, but it doesn't mean that I know that it's good. And so how do I get up to speed on the subject matters and, that are throughout law? that still requires reading cases and interacting with professors. And so that aspect of what we do has not changed so much at this point. And I still think, we have leaned into the humanity of our law school and the community that we have. We're very proud of our Jesuit identity. And for us, we say we're walking with you on this journey from day one, wherever it goes. We're with you outside the classroom, we're with you inside the classroom. And so some of this is we're learning this together. We're supporting our students, and we're trying to make sure that they have the best tools at their disposal so that they're graduating ready to practice law. But again, where do you get the wisdom? Where do you get the judgment? It's lived experience. It's learning from error. It's having the space to make mistakes and to have the care from professors to help dust them off afterwards.
Yeah, one of the things we're seeing in a challenge in accounting is particularly when students graduate and they go to the firm, a lot of those lower level tasks are being taken up by AI. I'm not making a direct parallel to what you've got, but that's kind of where you learn a lot. That's where you kind of learn the details and some of the ropes. And so the question is, how do you upskill these professionals to get them to this level that 3 or 4 years in where they're actually going to be starting out at. It's interesting.
And adding value. No, and I think that's true. And some of those trends in law, predate AI. So if you look at the hiring practices of large law firms, they changed dramatically in the last 10 years. They used to hire these really large classes of entering associates, and they would throw them on cases and document review and all kinds of things. And then clients started to say, we're not paying for you to train new attorneys. And we're just simply not going to, we're not going to pay the bills for these kinds of routine tasks. In some cases could be completed by paralegals. What did that lead to? It led to, okay, we're going to have to then change how we prepare these students so that they are still eligible for employment, but it may not be at the level that they came in at before. And so it's not uncommon now for large law firms to hire very few people right out of law school, but then hire more in year three or four or
Interesting.
five, as they know that they have at that point the training, the skills, the wisdom, the judgment to add value to clients, and they're truly adding something to the practice. Smaller firms that did more routine work, I have a friend who's very successful family law attorney, has 10 attorneys work for him. You would think, again, some of this stuff, wills and that sort of thing, you can find online. He's still finding lots of clients who want his help. Now, part of it is age related. So you got some segment of the population, just AI is not going to impact them much, right? But you have others still who, again, yeah, sure, I could do this online, but I want to know, right? I want to have somebody that I can trust. And, so it's not fully replacing the kind of commodities work that some are saying it will or overnight do. Maybe 10 years from now, we'll see that change, but I think that's where it's at right now.
Well, and speaking with AI, there's also an increase in the demand for lawyers around the development of AI, right? Your background's intellectual property protection and things like that. So that was one of the early concerns with AI was how is it going to navigate this world of research and finding information while also not violating copyright protections and things like that. So are you seeing that as an increase in need for lawyers in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think intellectual property is a love of mine. It's something that I practice in the past, practice still a little bit on the trademark side mostly, but also just teaching it. And it's so, what I love about it is it's constantly evolving. Whenever there's new technology, there are AI implications. And if we don't understand what those are, we run the risk of, major boo-boo, major error. And it's the things you put patent infringement, copyright infringement. Some of these things are being litigated right now, and we don't have all the answers yet. But to be conversant in this stuff, I think is really important for attorneys in the knowledge economy. And so I look at it now when I have taught intellectual property before, I said, look, you may not go into this full bore, and that's totally okay, but having a little bit of knowledge of this stuff, I think, is crucially important in the knowledge economy in 2025 and beyond. And so we have seen, you know, when we offer the introduction to intellectual property law class, we have 40 to 60 students in it reliably, right? That's the kind of class that if you look back in law schools, you know, 20 years ago, many law schools didn't even offer that class, right? And then they started to offer it, and you'd have, you know, 15 people who wanted to be patent attorneys, and that was it. People who wanted to be business attorneys, it wasn't seen as an even suggested offering, right? And that has changed, where it is now really part of the business law curriculum, even if that's not, again, what you're going to go into is your full-time practice.
It's interesting. I mean, Dr. Herzog and I do want to make a quick public service announcement. So Dr. Herzog has recently been elected faculty president at Gonzaga. Very, very excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely. But we were in a meeting earlier today with a gentleman who was emphasizing a lot of what we've talked about, but in the context of data, how no matter what your line of business is, you're going to have to realize or know how numbers work and how to read data. Similar parallels to what you're, you know, technology or where you go.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the knowledge of technology itself is becoming more of a requirement for all professionals, right? It's no longer, oh yeah, you can just have a younger person in your firm or your company who does that sort of thing. I was lucky starting out in my practice at McGuire Woods. You know, I did intellectual property litigation, but there were some things that came in the door that most of the folks just didn't have the same familiarity with. And in that day and age, it was domain names. And so, you know, there's a big trademark component to domain names. You know, registering a domain name that has someone else's trademark, you know, can in and of itself be an act of infringement. And so many companies, you know, try to buy every domain name that they think under the sun someone might use, you know, but they can't get them all. And then it's a game of whack-a-mole and how do you stop, you know, infringers. And so I got to build up a practice in this area because frankly, some people just didn't know how it worked. You know, like what is it? How do you actually buy a domain name? Right? How do you register one? You know, senior, some partners that there just wasn't anything that they did. Yeah. So those cases got kicked my way. And all, before you know it, I'm doing like 25% of my work involved that kind of stuff. Now, of course, with apps and everything else, it's, you know, how we access information has changed. Domain names still have a role to play, but it's not what it was, you know, in the early 2000s. Sounding like an old person now, but.
Well, I mean, with just AI and you think about how people are using AI to imitate voice and imitate image and pictures, right? There just seems to be this whole potential, well, not potential, but path of where the legal aspects of using AI are going to.
I come back to trust because I think that is really so much of what is at play with new technology. How do we trust the new technology? How do we know what's true? These are, you know, deeply liberal arts rooted kinds of questions, right? And so, again, I don't see any of this displacing the need for education. And it, to the contrary, it only heightens the stakes for those who have it and those who don't. I read an article the other day about families should have basically a safety word so that if you get a call from what appears to be dad and what sounds like dad asking you to wire money, you know, because dad's in a tight spot or whatever, you know, kid knows to ask for that safety word to not fall for the deep fake. And I thought, boy, is this the world that we're living in now? But obviously, yeah, we're going to be in an era where how do we know that this is true? And whether it's political disinformation, whether it's, you know, businesses coming at you with sort of unscrupulous schemes and offers. I mean, I think truth, again, the pursuit of truth, the knowledge of it, trust, these things are still going to be the province of educated people. And it makes what we do more important than ever.
Well, I think the trust is a key thing. The safe word thing is actually a conversation I just had with my dad as my family is going through a hacking attempt or a phishing attempt on bank accounts and things like that. And so, you know, we're talking about how AI is being used to imitate voice, and it's going to quickly spread to voices that it can capture. And if there's a public voice, the technology's there and it's going to start calling you at 2 in the morning when you're going to least expect it, and you're going to be groggy and not know any different. It's going to catch you off guard, and next thing you know. So I think that trust thing is we're at a stage where I think there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of kind of skepticism around AI because I think people just don't trust it yet.
No, I agree, and it's, as we know, some of these platforms are created to agree with you. They're created to want to engage, you want to engage with them more. And I see a world where, people are having conversations, well, my ChatGPT says this, well, my ChatGPT says that. And so we still have to negotiate the truth between those two things. Now, if both of the chats agree, then it must be true, right? It is like, I get to bring in my own little shadow army of technology that, of course, believes what I say because of its my history of prompting and everything else. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is language and all of this. And there's courses now on AI prompting. I go back to why do people go to law school? They like language. They like to read language. They like to use language, right? Technology and AI is still part of that. And you get the option one, do you like this response? Do you like this? We're seeing there's so many different ways to get at the same thing. What we're trying to get at is the best thing, the true thing, the right thing for the moment, for whatever is needed. And that is still where law schools and lawyers have a role to play, I think.
No, I agree. It takes a long time for society, for us to build up trust. You look at technologies, go to the self-checkout kiosks. Those have been around for 20 years. And still, you go to Costco and we're all mostly just standing in line to check out, right? You don't go to Costco. But autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles, right? Do we trust? How long is it going to take for us driving on a freeway to look over to our right and see a semi without a driver, right? Do we trust that system? And AI is very much in that same boat of when are we going to trust it to answer these questions in a way that we feel safe?
I couldn't agree more.
Pivot here. Let's talk about the Wine Law Institute. Yeah. Something you came up with. I remember in the early days, you kind of pitched the idea, and I was like, yeah, that sounds kind of fun. I don't know if it's got legs. It's done very well.
It has, and it made a lot of sense for us. So credit also to my colleague, Professor Jessica Kaiser, who, when I started in this role in 2018, came to me with a binder full of ideas, and this was one of them. And in talking to some other people, to Kelly Testi, who is had been dean at UW Law School and Seattle U Law School, she said, Gonzaga is perfectly suited to do something involving wine and law. And we're a private institution. We're in, the second largest grape growing state in the United States. We're not far from Walla Walla. If anyone could do this credibly, it's us. It's not going to be some urban law school. It's not going to be some law school in the middle part of the country. And if you look at the California schools, a lot of them are public, and then the private ones are super fancy and probably wouldn't view this as something that is worth their time. And so we did some market research, and sure enough, right, there's nothing out there on the legal aspects of wine in terms of an educational program. There's a lot on viticulture, horticulture, how to become, a person who makes wine, some business education, but not really all that much. And a lot of it is coming out of community colleges, right? Which makes sense given their missions. So we saw an opportunity to kind of jump into this space and make it fun and approachable and educational. So this program has evolved. We have a certificate program. We also have what I would call modules that people can engage with a la carte. And so the debundling of the program is one of the innovations that's occurred over the years. We now have our Center for Lifelong Learning at Gonzaga, which I think is, doing wonderful things with Rochelle Strother's leadership. And so she's been a big proponent of this program as well. So it's now a thing where students can access this material on their own time and do it at a pace that makes sense for them. There's still educational projects that they have to turn in and complete if they want to get the certificate. And if they just want the information without getting the certificate, that's a pathway as well. We've also done in-person events as part of the Wine Institute. And so we have so many of our alums at Gonzaga University more broadly have gone into the wine industry and been quite successful as winemakers or working in different companies. So one of our early sponsors of this was Chateau Saint-Michel. That came about because we had a law school graduate who was pretty high up in their in-house legal department. And so we had them as an early sponsor of this program. Winemaker Russell Bevan, of course, a business school grad. Winemaker Justin Wiley, business school grad. These are some of the folks who have been really helpful in our engagement with the industry. And then, of course, we haven't even talked about Florence and our beautiful campus over there. We've used that as a center, as a location, as a hub for continuing legal education in the wine law space. And so one of the things, I think this summer will be our sixth iteration of our wine law CLE. And we bring together 30 to 40 people, friends of Gonzaga, alums, benefactors. The unifying experience is they love Italy and usually they love wine. And we have this remarkable history with the Antinori family because of Gonzaga and Florence renting space in their villa in Florence, where really they provided full access to their whole team of professionals, in-house, outside counsel. Their top vice presidents, president even has met with our group. And of course, Piero Antinori, the Marchese himself, 2 years ago, we got to walk with him at his estate in the Tignanello vineyard. Well, this is their flagship wine. Many call it TIG in the United States. And we were there for lunch and learning from him and literally walking the vineyard. So it's led to a lot of really kind of neat points of engagement for our law school and our university.
And I believe that is that's a family-run company, and it goes back to
20 generations, something like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Well, what's the next institute? Is there a bourbon institute on the horizon?
Yeah. Actually, we've had a number of people over the years say, well, why limit it to wine? Why not, beer? Also, why not spirits? Why not marijuana? Obviously, there's a lot of different possibilities there, and our only limits are time and money. So I think they're all good ideas. And maybe we will add in, some of these programs. It's very niche. That's part of the appeal, is that it's actually pretty hard to find information in these spaces. There's not a lot of people doing these things. We've had people go through the program who are attorneys in states where you wouldn't think of these as wine growing states or wine producing states. Texas, for example, has actually some decent wines that they're making. We had someone come through our program, no connection to Gonzaga, learned about it online, and said, I want a credential that will distinguish me from the other attorneys who are seeking to service the growing wine industry in Texas. Went through our program, put the badge on her LinkedIn profile. Still keep up with this person. Examples like that, I think, show the value of these kinds of programs. You will find there's more out there on beer.
Yes.
There's growing, resources now on marijuana. But certainly these are spaces that we could, I can envision stepping into and in partnership with others too. I mean, that's been one limit for us is we don't try to do this all in-house. So, between Jessica and I, we've taught some of the modules, but then we bring in the experts from the industry to actually, as offer and teach these modules. So that would be, I think, the critical component. To be credible, we got to have true experts doing this. And it can't just be who wants to get up to speed on this and try to put something together. And so, the feedback that we have about our program is that actually this is really good stuff. That's the wine law program.
Well, and just to touch on the AI stuff we were talking about earlier, these are things that you need the human touch and connection with, right? You can go to AI and say, give me a list of ideas for institutes. And it might give you a list, but putting it together, doing all of the things necessary for it to be successful is where you need the leadership and you need the kind of people around you to help brand the program and build it and
Absolutely. And what I'm about to say next is no critique on anyone, but it's just more of an observation about what higher education doesn't do well is listen to industry and say, how can we align this program to better serve your needs? Where we started out with Chateau Saint-Michel was kind of interesting in that point because they saw a value in bringing members of their workforce up to speed on the legal and business aspects of wine, including people who work for them who were not attorneys, right? But who need to understand a little bit about the legal regulation behind wine. And so I can't speak for them, but as I recall those conversations, they were motivated to sponsor this program because it got them access to the material. And also, as part of our agreement, they gave us some experts to do these modules. So it was kind of a win-win for everyone. They then got purchased by Altria. Leadership changed, things changed, our, alliance with them changed. I can envision future such alliances. You think of like a big retailer like Total Wine, right? A lot of people get their wine from Total Wine. You go in there because people are knowledgeable. Imagine this being a benefit for that workforce. You're new to the company. We're going to put you through this go at your own pace program through our partnership with Gonzaga and, any new employee there gets, gets access. There are lifelong learners who have also come into the program. Imagine partnering with whether it's AAA or AARP or some organization like that, where they're looking to provide benefits to their membership. This could be one thing. So we have these ideas. Where we run into the limit is we have all these other things that we have to do as an ABA accredited law school, right? And so I would love to see more partnerships in this arena because I think it could be a win for everyone.
And one of the things you just said is that higher ed needs to get better at listening to industry. And with you in your law school, you have a sense, little bit more flexibility and freedom to build a curriculum or to change a curriculum or to develop an institute than maybe for those that don't understand the rest of higher ed. You don't have the same committees and university policies governing that. So how can you take your model? And how can other entities on campus do something similar, right?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I'm not fully prepared to think through or answer in my role as dean. I think I've been the lucky beneficiary of my predecessors in this role. I'm going back decades for whatever reason had the idea at the time in the early 70s, for example, to start to create some separate financial boundaries around how the law school operated. And I've heard different stories about how that came to be, and some may be true, some may be less than true, I don't know. But what it has resulted in is an atmosphere where the law school budget is pretty much on its own bottom. And so that's a great thing when times are good. It's not so great when times are not good. And every industry has its cycles. So we've been through those. When I started in 2018, the law school was trying to get out, coming out of, 6 to 8 rather down cycles in legal education. And that's a whole other topic of how we dealt with that and, why we found ourselves in that moment. Since then, it's been a growth story, which has generated revenue, a big portion of which we get to devote to law school projects and of a variety of different sort, programmatic building, even the physicality of the building and doing some renovations, some things like that. So we've had some degrees of freedom that I recognize that others have not. The other piece of it is, like I mentioned, going back to the 70s, this creation of a separate 501c3 known as the Gonzaga Law School Foundation. The dean of the law school is the de facto president of that organization. It has its own fiduciary, board. And that organization has provided a lot of opportunity over the years for financial investment in different projects at the law school, including student scholarship support, faculty travel, faculty scholarship support. The priorities have changed as the needs have changed and the leadership has changed, but the constant has been we've had access to pools of money that others have not. And so we are very fortunate, I think, in that regard. Now those assets are managed as part of the overall university endowment management structure, but they do still have to benefit the law school. And so I think current market value of our foundation is $37 million. And so anyway, that's kind of been, I think, the nuts and bolts of what has enabled some of this. And not all law schools are that fortunate. So, you know, many it's central, you know, management of the entire budget, and the law school gets allocated what they get allocated, good year or bad. They're, you know, they may find the allocation to be the same. And so that creates a different incentive structure. And then also, not every law school has one of these separate foundations. University has a foundation, of course, but you know, what's earmarked for the law school gets negotiated separately as part of that setup.
Well, I mean, that explains a lot, but just because you hinted at this, and we won't go into it, but when you came to Gonzaga, as I recall, in a number of meetings talking about where the law school was, the future of the law school at Gonzaga being really questioned. I think our enrollments were under 200, if I remember
No,
right.
they were just around 300.
Just around 300,
Yeah,
and now they're
total.
over 500.
Yeah, we're close to 600.
600, so
Yeah.
nearly double size.
Yeah, it's been you know, it's been fun to be here when I've been here. And so, you know, you don't choose your context, and I don't think we could have predicted going into COVID that we would come out of COVID where we did. But you know, I credit our then president for really, you know, being committed to an in-person educational experience and offering that as soon as we could. And I think that gave us a head start over some of our other law school competitors that were clinging to an online experience. What we found, you know, is that the ease of being in Spokane, Washington, the ease of being at our law school, the beauty of it, the physicality of it, the in-person nature, the humanistic part of it. A lot of students are attracted to those things. And so COVID helped us realize that and market with that in mind. If you think about it, you know, there's 202 or 203 ABA accredited law schools. A lot of them are in big cities. And in many big cities, there's multiple law schools in those cities. So what are they competing on? They're competing on prestige, they're competing on cost, maybe job placement, alumni network, right? But the actual experience of being there is maybe pretty similar. You're paying to live in a big city, you're having to commute, be in traffic, take the train, maybe, you know, find parking, pay for parking, all of these things, which are usually not very attractive to people, but just sort of got to do it if I'm going to further myself in my career. Here, you can come spend 3 years with us in a beautiful environment with access to lakes and mountains and streams and skiing and, you know, great intercollegiate sports and an undergraduate campus environment with leaves in the fall and all the things. And then go back to a big city or to your home state or wherever you want to go. But in the meantime, you've paid less. You've really loved being where you are. You've been in a community where you get to know people and they get to know you. You know, these things actually sound pretty good compared to some of the alternatives. And so we've really leaned in to that post-COVID and finding that there is definitely a market for it.
One last question for you here. I know you've done a lot of collaboration with industry across campus. What opportunities do you see for collaborating with the business?
Yeah, so I think there's quite a few. You know, this just-in-time education, lifelong learning, weekend education, law and business are it's peanut butter and jelly to me. I mean, they're two disciplines that should go really well together. You have business students who need a little bit of legal knowledge to really further their employability and knowledge of the field. You have lawyers who really need to understand business to be good business law advisors. I mean, here's the irony of it. You have some people who go straight through law school. I was one of them. Never work in business, but what are they doing? They're advising businesses when they graduate from law school. So I think the sooner we can bring these two together for students who want to do it, right? Some are always going to be interested in, more public service oriented work, prosecution, defense, government work, et cetera. But I would say easily more than half of our students are business inclined, business curious, business interested, and at the law school level. So we have to find more pathways for, collaboration. Think of, business pitch competitions, right? What if we had a law student who is on a team, who's there to help advise and think of things on the fly? We haven't really done any of that work together on the undergraduate side. On the MBA side, we have a few students who pursue, the dual degree program. But at many schools, that's a pathway that is quite robust, and not just in terms of students, how many students are pursuing it, but all the ancillary offerings around it. So I would love for us to see here enhanced collaboration. And I think, certainly I'm all in on that, because I think it further enhances the education of our students.
Well, we appreciate your time here. I know we got to get out to the Creighton game here pretty soon, but
It's
thanks for
been my
coming.
pleasure. You both are gentlemen and scholars. Thanks for inviting me in and have joined us, enjoy this opportunity.
This has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. Your host was Andrew Brasich, edited by Stuart Herringer.
Negotiations for printing. Oh, no, the Indiana State Fair. You told me we're going to cut whatever we want to cut. We're going to do this soon. He was just telling me he was such an exceptional. When did you tell me that? I
I
don't
don't know
know.
when it
He
came up.
worked the Indiana State Fair. He's so exceptional. Like they made him like the chauffeur of the main show.
Yes, I
So,
got to drive Kenny Chesney to and from the airport, take care of all of his needs.
yeah.
Got that.
And the entourage. Yeah, that's
Oh, sure.
perfect.
I've seen his driving skills, so it must have been a pretty low bar.
Yeah.